From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Like Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we learn about the fight against subsidized housing in New Berlin and what it can teach us about current fights over these developments. Then we meet the state's first ever female chief state forester and learn what she hopes to do in the role.
In my career, we've always probably lagged behind as far as the number of women. So it is an exciting time, and I'm really excited to be kind of that face because I think that's an important first step.
Plus, singer-songwriter Peggy James joins us for our Pandemic Performer Series.
That's about the only thing I could do is I could write a song and just pour my heart out about the condition of the country and how divided we are as a nation. I didn't want to take a side, though. You know, I just wanted to present the feeling in the country right now.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Like Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. One of the defining issues in the latter days of President Trump's presidential campaign was low-income housing. The president claimed that President-elect Joe Biden would force suburban communities to build low-income housing, which Mr. Trump claimed would bring crime and lower home values. These same issues were at the heart of a decade-old dispute over affordable housing here in the Milwaukee area. A developer proposed a complex for low-income housing in New Berlin and sparked immediate controversy. But the predictions of doom and gloom never materialized. Reporter John Eligaw wrote about what happened in New Berlin for the New York Times, and he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about it.
Now, when I think of low-income or subsidized housing, I don't necessarily think of New Berlin, Wisconsin as being a big hub for this. Why did you choose to focus on New Berlin for this story?
Yes, well, indeed, New Berlin is not a hub for it. And that's what made it a story, right? Because during the presidential campaign, one of President Trump's big pitches to suburban voters was that he was going to keep, quote unquote, low-income housing out of their communities. He said that that type of housing would bring crime, that it would drive their property values down. As I heard him say that, it made me think of New Berlin, because as I was doing another story about housing in Milwaukee several years back, I remember I came across the story of what happened in New Berlin back in 2010 when they had proposed an affordable housing or low-income housing complex and all the backlash and the concerns about that. So I wanted to explore like what actually ended up happening in New Berlin and whether President Trump's greatest fears that low-income housing will bring crime and hurt property values, whether that did actually happen in a place like New Berlin in a suburban community like that.
As you mentioned, President Trump really played on a lot of fears about subsidized housing. And as you read your piece, you bring up a lot of these different fears that people in New Berlin had and part of what their objections were to creating this type of housing. Can you give us some background on what the fight looked like there and the kinds of things that people were concerned about?
Yeah, so the fight in New Berlin was actually very similar to fights that you've seen over affordable housing throughout the country, really. You know, this thing, what people call NIMBY, which is not in my backyard, it is a phenomenon that has happened, you know, basically for as long as we've had affordable housing, which is when housing development is proposed, you often have people in those communities, especially when they are more affluent white communities, who will stand up against it and will say, you know, we don't want it. And the arguments they make are the arguments that President Trump was making. They say it's going to bring crime. You know, they look at housing projects of the past that were built in the 70s, 80s. And they see some of those communities that, you know, have struggled with crime. They see them as buildings that have become dilapidated. So people raise those same concerns. Are we going to have crime here like that? Is this project going to turn into a dilapidated building that's going to bring down our property values? So that was a lot of the sentiment. And a lot of it, there's a racial element to a lot of it in the sense that oftentimes in our public imagination, affordable or low-income housing is associated with Black and brown people, right? It's associated with people from inner city communities that are struggling where there's a lot of minorities living there. And so what you heard in a place like New Berlin, you heard things like, I don't want my community to turn into the north side of Milwaukee. That's what someone wrote to the mayor you had people saying it at public meetings that, hey, we worked hard to get in here, not because we got a handout. So like, we deserve to be here. But these people, you know, they implied that these people who would live there would be getting a handout. The mayor himself at the time, someone sprayed a racial slur on his fence at his house because he had supported the project. So there was this really racial element to it that really underlines a lot of the concerns when these housing development surveys are proposed.
What's interesting about that is I think when you take a look from the outside, the racist aspects of this fight are pretty clear. But the people who were against this project initially didn't seem to recognize that many of these objections were racist.
Race is a complicated thing in our society, right? Because on the one hand, you do have instances, you know, where there have been affordable housing built or low-income housing. And that has led to, you know, neighborhoods that, you know, maybe been more crime-ridden or, you know, neighborhoods that are not quite as desirable. The thing that people miss is that there are very complicated issues with that, right? It's not simply that the people who are living there are bad. It's not that type of thing. But it's when you build these projects sometimes in communities, oftentimes those communities get disinvested. Those are intentional decisions that have been made by, you know, stakeholders involved to disinvest in these communities. These are places where you concentrate a lot of poverty. So you have, you know, lots of low-income housing developments all clustered into one community. Then you have, you know, a lot of concentration of poverty. And then that can oftentimes lead to some of the issues, some of the problems that people were concerned about. So people will look at that and say, no, I'm just worried about that. You know, I'm not seeing their skin color. I'm not seeing their race, you know, kind of ignoring the fact that their perceptions of the people living there are deeply ingrained, you know, with the perceptions that we have of Black people in this country, with the perceptions that we have of crime being associated with Black people in inner city and slums and things like that, all these stereotypes that people have in their heads, you know. So while, yes, on its surface, what you're saying, you're not necessarily saying the N-word, you're not necessarily, you know, burning a cross saying, don't come here. But there are definitely these associations that people have with this type of housing that are inextricably linked to race and how we view people through the prism of race and what type of person would live in affordable housing. And just another thing I'd say to that point is that one example you saw of this is people saying, you know, the people who supported the development, the mayor and the developer, they went out of their way to say, this is not low-income housing. They said, this is workforce housing, suggesting that because of the structure of how it's structured with like tax credits and things like that, that this would attract actually working people. What that assumes is that people who are in the quote low-income housing projects, that they don't work, which is just not true, right? Like studies have shown that most able-bodied working age people who live in some sort of low-income housing or get some sort of subsidy, they actually work, right? So these are all stereotypes and things that have been perpetuated for many generations that I think, you know, you really saw come through in a place like New Berlin.
I will say my sister actually lives in subsidized housing and she does indeed work.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, like I'm assuming your sister is white. I don't know.
Yes,
but like,
I'm white.
That's the thing that people don't appreciate is that like public housing when it was first built, one, it was segregated. So the first projects were just for white people and Black people were not allowed in them. And then the other thing that people don't realize, there's a lot of white people who live in that housing too, right? What the stereotypes and what the perception in people's minds are does not often fit the reality.
Yeah. And these stereotypes seem to be the driving force behind the opposition that was in New Berlin. Now, how did this fight ultimately play out?
Yeah, so what happened was that when the city denied the development and did not allow them to build there, the developer sued. But then also the Justice Department, which at the time was during the President Obama administration, the Barack Obama administration, the Justice Department also sued and basically said that the city was violating the Fair Housing Act because it was denying building this project based on the potential race of the prospective tenants. Basically, that lawsuit was brought forth, and eventually the city came to a settlement with the government and with the developer, in which the city agreed to allow the development to be built, among many other things. You know, they had to like market that they were having affordable housing in the community. They had to do all these other things. But the main thing was they had to allow the development to be built. So the development was built. It opened in late 2012. And then it opened up and you had people start to move in. And just a quick note on the structure of this, because I think it's worth like noting the history. When we think about public housing, like government built public housing, that's not really a thing anymore. That's what people think of when they think of these slums and Cabrini Green and other projects. They think of government. That's not what this is, right? Because the government basically in the 80s, they stopped building that, those kind of tenement type style housing. That stopped. Most new affordable housing now is built by private developers, and those developers receive tax credits to build those units. And in exchange for those tax credits, they have to put some of those units at below market rate. So there's usually a mix of incomes in there. So you have people who are paying less than market rate because they only make a certain amount. And then you have people who are, you know, above the income threshold, and they're paying market rate. So you could have someone in a two bedroom in this place who's paying $1,500, and then another family who's on an income restriction who's paying $700 for the same unit, right? So that's what this is. So this opened up, and it's a place for, you know, mixed income families. Most people in there are income restricted. So they do have units that are below market rate, but there are some market rate units. So the development's there. It kind of fits right into the community. And when I talk to people in the community now, they say, like, in some ways, they don't even notice it. It's just like any other apartment building. It's in a part of the city called the city center. The public library is there. There's a creek. There's a farmer's market that they have there where that's on when, you know, when it's warm outside. So yeah, I mean, it's just kind of like a building there now, and people barely even notice it.
You had a chance to talk to some people who initially did oppose this building. What do they think about it now?
I guess first I'll say is some of the most staunch opponents. So there was a group that was formed back in 2010 to oppose the project. The people who belong to that group generally, most of them just wouldn't even return my calls. Like, most of them did not want to talk to me, the most staunch opponents. I did talk to some people. Like, there was one man who I write about in my article who wrote a letter to the mayor saying that if I wanted to live next to, quote, low-cost housing people, I would have stayed in Milwaukee. And so this guy, I approached him at his home. And, you know, he said he actually regretted what he wrote, because he was one of those who said, yeah, he had this stereotype in his mind that it was going to be like a Cabrini Green or something like that, which, you know, for those who don't know, Cabrini Green was a housing project in Chicago that was, you know, pretty notorious for being kind of dilapidated and things like that. But that's what he envisioned in his mind. And he said, you know, now it looks nice, you know, it's completely fine. And he said he regretted writing that letter. And his words to me were like, if they wanted to build another one, more power to them, you know? So he was basically saying, it's not the issue that I thought it was going to be. And I've learned from that. The current mayor, who at the time he was an alderman in the city board of aldermen, he was very opposed to it. What his response to me was like, he said, it's really nice. The housing is really rather attractive is what he told me. And he also told me that they were able to solve some of the issues that were brought up, like the issues about parking, the issues about traffic. So he put it as an issue like, oh, we did all the zoning things right, so this turned out okay, right? And so he wouldn't kind of address the elephants in the room, which is the crime and those types of issues that people brought up that never came to fruition. He said, no, it's not there. But he kind of pawned that off and saying, oh, that was just some people. That was a few people who were saying that, not many. Which, when you look at these council meetings, like I watched video of some of these meetings, people were very vigorously opposed to it. And then that was a big reason. Yeah. So you got that. And then there was one woman, she actually wasn't quoted in the article because we didn't have all the space, but she's an 84-year-old woman now. She was, I guess, 74 at the time. She had made a comment at the meeting saying that, basically one of those comments saying that people needed to work hard so they could deserve to live in New Berlin. And I asked her about that. She insisted that, no, she was not trying to say that they did not deserve to live here. She said she actually wanted more Black people living in New Berlin, but she was afraid that if we were to build this housing project, it was just going to segregate any Black people who come to the city. And then we were going to create this segregation within our city. That was her way of putting it. And it's just to note, New Berlin is more than 90% white. You know, it's a mostly white community. So yeah, you had a lot of, you know, I guess the one guy I mentioned, like, who said he regretted it. You had fewer people who were, you know, just audibly like saying, no, that was wrong of me, and more just trying to explain away and kind of like explain their concerns. And I guess the last woman I would point out, another one who I talked to, she's actually, you know, a Democrat. This is a mostly Republican city, it's New Berlin. She's white herself. She's married to a Mexican man, and she was opposed to it. And she said her opposition came because she used to work for a nonprofit in Milwaukee that fixed up affordable housing. And she saw that even when they fixed it up, it would still like make these communities go bad. And her response was like, yeah, actually it did not turn out, you know, the way my experience was. So that changes my mind, you know, about it, you know. And she actually said she's become so disgusted with some of the other opponents who are Republicans, who are conservative. She said they've become so racist, that they've become conspiracy theorists and stuff like that. So she doesn't even associate with them anymore. At the same time, while she says she would be more okay with it now, she said, quote, to me, as long as it's not in my backyard. And by that, she meant she still doesn't want it in her neighborhood, but if they were to build it somewhere in the city, she wouldn't be that opposed. So it's a very complicated thing, and there's really a range of views that people held.
Hmm. You mentioned, of course, the interesting history of affordable low-income housing in the United States and public housing. You mentioned, of course, Cabrini-Green, and when you unpack the history of Cabrini-Green, it's fascinating to see kind of how our perceptions have evolved over time and how they've changed as the racial makeup of low-income housing has changed for a variety of reasons. As we look to the future, understanding what we do about our past as it pertains to low-income housing, what are the kind of struggles that we're still seeing in communities? What are the kinds of issues that we're still seeing in getting more low-income housing?
Well, the issue is still exactly what it was 10 years ago in some ways, I would say, which is the stereotypes and the perception, the horrors in people's minds of what low-income housing is or affordable housing is, right? A lot of people don't know that this isn't government-built housing. They don't know these are private developers. And generally, these developers are building, while it won't be like the most high-end luxury condo, they usually build them in the style that fits in with the community. In New Berlin, it actually has, you know, granite countertops, stainless steel appliances, and things like that, you know? So people don't really realize like what it actually is, right? And I guess the other thing that people don't understand too is, yes, you have examples of affordable housing where, you know, the communities are tougher. It's a more of a struggle in some of those communities, right? But the issue is because of the fact that places like New Berlin are so opposed to it and developers don't go there and don't build it there, that's why this ends up happening, because you end up putting them all the affordable housing in one place. And when you put it all in one place, that is almost an inevitable outcome that it's going to struggle there, because you're going to have a lot of people there who are on lower incomes, and it's going to be a place where people are not going to be invested in. There's not going to be the opportunities there for people to get jobs. There's not going to be opportunities for people, you know, to send their kids to schools with the, that are fully resourced. So the idea is that you build it in communities like New Berlin. The idea is that communities across an entire region, across the country, take on their share of affordable housing. And then what you end up having, you have something like New Berlin, where there's one or two housing developments that are affordable housing, but you barely notice that it's affordable housing because it's not just a bunch of affordable housing clustered together. And it just, you know, kind of fits in, and you have people living there who get the same opportunities as everyone else in that community, who get this, the same grocery stores, get the same schools for their children, get the same jobs they can apply for in that area. So I think that's what we need to understand. We need to understand that, like, if you are in a community that's an affluent community, that's a mostly white community, and your community were to take on affordable housing, taking on one or two developments almost certainly will not bring, you know, a bunch of crime to your community. It won't bring your property values down. What it will do is it will give people who are working, who are mostly working and hardworking people, it will give them an opportunity to live somewhere. And it will also lift the burden from those communities that have to take every single last bit of affordable housing. It will reduce that barrier, and it creates a stronger ecosystem. And I'm not just talking about like some cultural, like, oh, like we're all living together thing. I'm talking about like the economy is stronger in those communities because you have people who are there to fill jobs and who are there to work. You have people there who are there paying taxes, that the tax base grows. So this adds populations, adds tax bases, adds workers to your community, on top of the social benefits of having people there who are from different backgrounds and things like that. So this can actually be a plus if done right, and if every community takes on their fair share.
John Eligah is a reporter covering race for the New York Times, and he spoke with LikeFact's Joy Powers about the fight for subsidized housing in New Berlin. After the break, we meet Wisconsin's new chief state forester, the first woman to ever hold the position. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Half of Wisconsin is covered in forests, so managing all that land is no easy task. It's up to the Wisconsin Forestry Division, which falls under the Department of Natural Resources, to keep the land healthy. The Forestry Division works with federal, county, and private landowners. It's a team of about 420 people scattered all across the state. and the person leading that division is Heather Berkland. Last month, she was named Chief State Forester, the first woman to ever hold the position in state history. Berkland's forestry career spans two decades. She studied natural resources at UW-Stevens Point and is now working in northern Wisconsin near Rhinelander. She spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz, about her new role and begins by explaining her interest in forestry.
I realized that really trees are kind of the foundation of an entire healthy ecosystem. And so I was really drawn to trees and all the advantages and benefits of the forest. So I just pursued a career there. And I also just really valued being a public servant. So I wanted to definitely gear towards the public sector and was able to land a job right away with the DNR out of college. They had an opportunity to hire quite a bit aggressively those first few years. And so here I am 20 years later.
What were you doing in your first job or maybe the first couple of jobs?
Yeah, I was in a station where we have a diverse integrated field opportunities. And so my primary position was always working with private landowners and our tax law program. So heavy to kind of working with landowners, writing management plans. But part of the benefits of working for the DNR in these integrated field positions was you got to also do a lot of the other work. And so I really enjoyed the public land management piece as well. So partnering with the counties and setting up timber sales, working with loggers and administering the timber sales, also a heavy state lands management component. So being able to kind of plan and manage, do the reconnaissance of all of our state properties as well. And then also the opportunity to be in fire control. So help with kind of the fire prevention and suppression efforts. It was not my main role, but always played kind of a support role in having to staff for fires.
So approximately half of our state is forested, right?
Yes.
So again, as you just mentioned, this is a combination of federal, state, county, and private land or managed land. So that means, different programs, different relationships for all of those different sectors. That has to be very complicated.
Right. And don't forget tribal as well.
I was going to move to that.
Yeah. I really appreciate our, the Division of Forestry's purpose of working in partnerships, because there is such a wide plethora of different sectors and partners that we work with. And I do believe that our state, because we have that kind of foundation and relationships with so many entities that are managing our forests, that it's really been a benefit to actually helping kind of work together towards the same goal, keeping the forest healthy, having a sustainable industry. While each of them kind of have their kind of niche or their management objectives, I really think that we complement each other kind of for the holistic landscape kind of view on how we want to see our forests into the future.
A postage stamp question in a way. Up in your area, do you happen to know of Buffalo Lake?
Okay.
When it comes to trees, and obviously that impact on wildlife and water, you've got in that particular case that beautiful little deep lake there, and there's state parkland along once, I think a large portion of it. Would that be an example of or an illustration of state and public management?
You bet. So our state lands that we manage is about 1.5 million acres, and our state forest is about 500,000 acres. So Buffalo Lake falls within our state forests. And then we have our state parks, our natural areas, wildlife areas, and that's about 1 million acres, all under the umbrella of being managed by cross programs in the DNR. So the Division of Forestry gets to kind of work with our internal partners on kind of balancing the forest management side of it with the recreation, wildlife objectives, air quality, water protection. And so it is a great intersect. And the state forest, I would say, is a good example of a working forest. While we try and, our objectives are multidimensional, we want to see that all of that diversity out there, it is working, and we are actively managing it to make sure that we have a trees for the future. Whereas, a parks would be more towards the recreation side of things. However, you know, everybody likes to see big trees and wants to see trees in the future. So like we said, we're providing that technical expertise to make sure that we do keep that health of the forest, get rid of the invasives, provide buffers along lakes for increased water quality. You know, so a multitude of opportunities for management and opportunities for uses of the forest. So that was a great example, I think, that you provided to kind of showcase that.
So obviously management means coping with disease. Lots of us have emerald ash borer in our brains. So has that been a devastating on the state's forest canopy?
Yes, it's definitely something that the greater forestry community has been having to kind of grapple with. You know, pests have been around for a long period of time, and we kind of try to adapt and species adapt, but it definitely has taken a toll in certain parts of the state, as well as our urban forested communities. And so trying to replant in those areas, diversify, we're also kind of looking at what other different species might be able to adapt to these sites where ash was, also kind of piggybacking that with kind of some climate change and adaptation opportunities and kind of different trials on how to convert the forest from ash to something else. Anytime we have those kind of widespread pests come through, it definitely takes all hands on decks with all partners to try and kind of manage and think about how we're going to mitigate it and adapt.
I read that there is a timber sale coming up fairly near Milwaukee in the Whitewater area, and that's focused, I believe, on removing emerald ash borer affected trees. I read that those trees were actually marked and advertised for sale back in 2015. So this is a long process, and it folds into the master management plan that's designed specifically for this area.
Yeah, so we do have what we call master plans for all of our properties that we manage. And this is something that's been evolving. Some of our larger, like state forest properties and some of our state parks, they've had master plans or an integrated property management plan, we would call them as well, for quite a period of time. But some of these scattered other lands didn't necessarily. It was often just maybe a local plan. A few years ago, we were charged with compiling based upon like the landscape and use and where these properties are located and updating all these kind of master plans. And so that they include, you know, the diversity of what the public is looking for. So you're right. This property would have a specific plan attached to it. Some of them are more extensive than others based on kind of the use and the size, location, how they fit in with a landscape of other properties and partners. But yes, and so that goes through public comment period. The Natural Resources Board also gets involved in approving these. And so once they are approved, that's basically like our working document on how we are going to meet those objectives for the public that's been identified, while also kind of making sure that we are stewards of the land as well to maintain, you know, the sustainability of those properties. So you're spot on. Sometimes this process can move through quickly, and in other places it may take several years to actually before a tree is actually harvested. And then afterwards, we're making sure we monitor, we follow up and update what it looks like, and then go back and make sure it's meeting the objectives that we want. And then we adapt based on the changing climate, the changing landscape.
2020 has been a big year for you and other women. The first woman who was elected as our vice president, and before that, you were chosen as Wisconsin's first woman to head the forestry division. Are there an increasing number of women in your field? Or has there been a balance as you've moved through your career thus far?
Great question. I think historically, obviously, we haven't had a lot of women, but there have been women that have definitely paved the way in the Division of Forestry. In general, the forestry profession, I think, is one that is lacking in diversity overall nationwide. And so it's definitely a movement across the nation in recognizing how can we get more diversity, more women, more people of color kind of embedded into the natural resources profession, and in particular forestry. And so in my career, I would say we've always probably lagged behind as far as the number of women, but there we are definitely seeing more. But I think it's just that it's, I don't think it's increased substantially. But it definitely is exciting when we can, you know, when we're working across partnerships as well and seeing our county forest partner, or the executive director, she is also a woman, and our cooperating forester in the private sector, seeing more women doing consulting forestry as well. And so it's definitely something that's very important to me and important to our leadership team as we're looking at long-term education, hiring, recruitment, and retention, and in ways we can start diversifying our profession. So it is an exciting time, and I'm really excited to be kind of that face, because I think that's an important first step.
So when you were announced as the new forestry division leader, your quote is as saying, "I look forward to leading the Division of Forestry on a successful path as we adapt to changes in the climate and cultural needs." So there's so much to that, obviously. What would you identify as the greatest challenge? And I guess part of it is I automatically think of climate change and one of the biggest opportunities in all this.
You know, I think it's just recognizing that trees can be part of the solution. You know, the carbon sequestration, the storing of carbon, the filtering of air pollutants, you know, the products we get, the renewable, it's a renewable resource. And so it's finding that balance of preserving woodland, but also actively managing it and using it for the benefits long-term of healthy climate. And so I think it's recognizing what we need to do to educate the public on the importance of trees and how it is connected to climate. And then I think the other challenge will always be is just the markets. Just recognizing that you need a robust industry as well in order to have a forested landscape for many years. So those two are big items that I think we always are kind of striving to make sure that we have that connection and keeping that in the forefront.
On the lighter side, what about your job or the mission of your division gives you the greatest joy? What do you like the best?
Oh, we just have a great group of staff that are very passionate, that are very skilled in what they do, and they just really know what it means to serve the public and work with the public. And so that's really been rewarding, you know, and we have, I think in the division, we've set the foundation. We have, you know, a strategic plan that every 5 years we're evaluating and making sure we're aligning with the public's needs and with the greater department's needs. And we also, you know, have some cultural beliefs that are really important about serving Wisconsin and adding value and working together in partnership. So I think just that foundation and the culture that the division has just been a really welcoming place to work, and just appreciate everything that our staff does and working with our partners as well.
Heather Berkland is the Chief State Forester in the Division of Forestry. She spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz. Coming up next, singer-songwriter Peggy James joins us for our Pandemic Performer series. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM.
The ground shook on the night you left, and lightning lit the sky. It cracked just like a whip across the backbone of the night. The trees were bending down so low, their leaves were blown away, and the birds flew round in circles, no place for them to stay.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. In normal times, Lake Effect features a variety of in-studio performances from local musicians and artists. But of course, these are not normal times. Most live events have been canceled, and recording music in isolation presents a lot of challenges, which is why we've been featuring these artists in a series we call Pandemic Performers. Singer-songwriter Peggy James was born in Milwaukee, but spent her formative years in the Southwest. This certainly influenced her music, which dances on the border of pop, rock, country, and bluegrass. But through it all, her lyrics have always remained timeless and heartfelt. James's fifth album, out now, Paint Still Wet, reflects that even a veteran artist is still in progress. She joins me to talk more about it and starts with how the Milwaukee music community helped launch her career.
You know, I wrote songs in the Southwest, but I never performed or recorded anything until I got to Milwaukee. And that's when I was really fortunate to meet some of the best, finest musicians around here that helped me begin. And my first two recordings were recorded by Mike Hoffman. I don't know if you know Mike. He was one of the best producers at the time that I was introduced to. And through him, I met a lot of musicians locally, great people, very supportive of my songs and my music. So in that kind of a way, I really was fortunate.
You know, we can definitely hear the Southwest influence in your music. So what did you take from your experience living there and then coming back to Wisconsin and adding, you know, a Midwest sensibility to it, I suppose?
Right. Well, I lived in Milwaukee till I was 10, and there's that song San Antone on the record. So there's a little bit of family history there. But what people might not know is that there was this freeway that was going to be built on Lyon Street, where the Pick and Save is now. And they were buying out all the houses on that track. And my mom and dad's house was one of them. So they had to move no matter what. They had to take the money that was offered to them for this freeway, which was never built. So anyway, my dad had a brother out in Phoenix, and he kept saying, "Oh, you should come out here. It's dry heat and we have a pool." And so my dad packed us all up and we moved out there, and I just loved it. I was younger than my other two older brothers. They didn't like it out there too much, but I just fell in love with the desert, and I had a girlfriend who had a horse, and we went riding every weekend for hours. And we lived right by a stable, just spent a lot of time in the desert, and I learned to love it out there, and I miss it still. So I go out there when every vacation that I can.
And how did your relationship with music either grow or change, having gotten that Southwestern influence and then coming back to Wisconsin? You've had a very long music career and many albums. So how have you found yourself growing into your own sense?
Yeah, well, I would say very country, country Western. And I did the thing where you go to Nashville, you sing at the Bluebird, you know, and go to the songwriter places and the Third Coast Cafe. They had an outdoor cafe there. So just did that thing. And I actually met with an A&R rep there and stuff. But they, even though I was a lot more country, they didn't quite know what to do with me. And I remember performing this one song, and this A&R rep came up to me afterwards and he says, "That's a great song, but what is it about?" So I don't know. I fit in, but yet I really didn't fit in. So I did that about three times. I went down there, and then I decided that I was just going to start my own band, because I wanted to do all original music. And we did that for several years, and it was fun, but it was a lot of work. And I was a single mom at the time too. So I had to work a full-time job, take care of my kids, practice, you know, at least once a week, and play out a couple times a week. That got pretty intense, but I needed the second job, you know, to just to make the bills. And I would say that meeting Mike Hoffman, he's a rock and roll guy. So he kind of added the rock and roll to my music. Otherwise, I probably would have been more of a folky person. But once I tasted that rock and roll, I was ruined. He ruined me. And then eventually I met Jim Iannelli, and he said he had a studio, and, you know, he invited me to come and do several songs, and the sound was great, and it turned into the third album. And then three albums later, here we are, and we work together really well, stylistically. He he likes my writing and I love whatever he does to it. So it's a good match.
Right. So this album, most recent album you worked on together, is called Paint Still Wet. So were there different original plans to record this in a traditional studio setting, or did the production change due to the pandemic, or is this something you were able to do regardless?
Oh, yes. In fact, I hate to say this, but it's actually worked in our favor because, you know, instead of focusing on other things in our life at the time, we were able to focus on this. And it gave us the time because you're stuck inside and we got to finish the album. Most of it was done before COVID-19. We actually had the guest artists come in before that. And that was a good thing. We got that part done. But then we just had to mix and master and polish it all up to, you know, I did the CD work and stuff, the artwork. And so it didn't affect us in that way at all.
Well, and how would you characterize this album? Because, you know, I was curious about the production because it is a very great, rich, full sound. You know, it doesn't sound like anything had to be impacted by it. It kind of gives a good storytelling scope, but kind of characterized as Midwestern melancholy. So how would you characterize this most recent album, Paint Still Wet?
Well, I think it's kind of like taking a tour from beginning to end. And, you know, it skips all the genres here and there, and it keeps it fresh and interesting. I don't even mind listening to it over and over again. In the car, it sounds great. So whenever we take a ride or something, we listen to it.
Well, that's definitely a good sign that you can listen to it over and over again, being the artist. So although the album Paint Still Wet has been released, you recently released a single called Hard Times. And the song starts with the lyrics, "People today are taking sides, holed up in their trenches, waiting for a fight." So tell us what inspired the message of this song and its release.
Well, I've never really been a real political person. Lately, I have been more tending towards it, like probably everybody has, because you're kind of glued to this election. But what inspired it the most was just the feeling that I had of the Americans, how all the Americans were kind of going through a very hard time. There was a lot of pain, a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear of the pandemic and then the election. And it's a very hard time for people to even take in everything that's happening. So, you know, there have been times in our country's history where the songwriters stepped up, like in the 60s, you know, you had songs about the Vietnam War and, you know, Kent State and different issues of the time. And then you have like Kitty Donahoe that wrote the song, There Are No Words, that beautiful song she wrote. And she actually sang and played that at the 9/11 tribute. So, you know, that's about the only thing I could do is I could write a song and just pour my heart out about the condition of the country and how divided we are as a nation. I didn't want to take a side, though. You know, I just wanted to present the feeling in the country right now.
Yeah, a reflective song.
Mm-hmm. And give a little bit of hope added to it that, you know, if we just stick together, we'll make it through this time.
Well, let's take a listen to that now.
People today are taking sides, hold up in their trenches, waiting for a fight. When you're filled with anger, reason's out the door. Everybody's talking. No.
So that was Peggy James' song, Hard Times. Peggy, you've been categorized as Americana throughout your career, and this album, as you mentioned, kind of jumps around genres. So would you say this recent album upholds to that, or how do you define yourself and your sound?
I like Americana because then I don't have to define it. It's just a good way to say Americana, you know. It puts a lot of things into the recipe, you know, I like Etta James a lot. Her, that song, Can't Do Lonely Anymore, is kind of like that blues jazz feeling. So when I write a song, you know, whatever comes out, I want to follow that song and not be held by any boundaries. You know, and I know it'd be easier for my success if I just would do a country album or a, you know, jazz blues album, but that's not me. So saying it's Americana is a nice little title. Yeah.
So you've been a musician pretty much all your life. Did music take on a different role for you during the initial lockdown? And as we were making this album, and as you mentioned, really having the time to properly put it together?
I don't think it was a different role. I just, because all those songs were written in 2019, and I had a very good songwriting year. Usually, you know, you hit some kind of a stump where you can't think of things, but these songs just were one right after another. So that's kind of me. I'm always writing songs, thinking of songs in my head. So that never changes no matter what's going on.
So let's hear one more song to take us out. Can you tell us about the song Lighter Than a Feather?
Mm-hmm. It's kind of a very personal song, and it's kind of obvious that it's about losing someone. It's about my dad. He passed away several years ago, and we were very close, even musically. He gave me my first guitar. He taught me my first chords. And we used to sing together, actually. And I would sing harmony to him. And he was a songwriter. So there's a line in there about how it seems like yesterday we were singing a song, you know. He was a big guy. He used to be a boxer. But he was so tender-hearted towards people. And I just admired him, and he was a beautiful soul. So I wanted to write a song saying something very positive, that you can't hold down a person like this, you know. It's like a falcon soaring in the wind. He was finally freed from this gravity. So to me, it's a very uplifting song, even though it's about someone, you losing someone. But that love can never go away.
Well, before we take a listen to this tribute to your dad, Peggy James, I want to thank you for joining us on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you so much.
You were once dead weight, now you're lighter than a feather. Like a falcon soaring on the wind, freed from its tether. And you've gone to a place where I've never been. And I know it's selfish, but I want you back again.
Peggy James is a singer-songwriter from Milwaukee, and we spoke with her as a part of our Pandemic Performer series. Her latest album, Paint Still Wet, is out now.
I looked in your eyes and we smiled as I sang along. And I know it's the way it must be, but it still seems so wrong. And I just can't get over the fact that you're really gone.
And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.